Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
You don't just rest here in the desolate hills. You didn't just choose the still universe of dust. You aren't a soul's projection in the void. Your memory is material, flesh, fire, oranges. Your footsteps won't startle the silent hall. At midnight, you won't return to the moon. You won't enter, transparent, without a whisper. Your hands won't seek out the dreaming zither. You won't transport a green halo from tower to tower like orange blossoms, extinguished and abandoned. Your ankles won't stir crystalline melodies at night. Only death unchained you. No, not a ghost, shadow moon above the iciness. Not tears, not lamentation, not a fugue of fluttering garments. But rather than body, that body wrapped in love. Those eyes sundering the earth. Those legs nestling the hussar's urgent fire. That wandering road captain. The legs mounting a horse in the lush forest. Descending in flight the alabaster ladder. The embracing arms, the fingers, the cheeks. The breasts, two dark hemispheres of magnolia. The bird of her long hair, two great black wings. Her round hips of equatorial bread. So, perhaps naked, you travel with the wind and it continues to be your stormy lover. And so you exist now as before, as matter and truth. You are life, never to be lost in death's translation. Your small dark hand, your slim Spanish feet, your clear hips of plenty. Ancient rivers of green fire travel through your veins. And you put everything on the table like a flaming treasure. The dead orange blossoms of abandonment in the blazing cards. In the game of life or extinction. Who is kissing her now? It is not he. It is not she. They are not themselves. It is the wind bearing a flag. This was the wounded lover. During the night woven with pathways, she dreamed of victory. She embraced the grief. Her lover was a sword. You were freedom. A liberator. In Love. Ceremonial Songs by Pablo Neruda, 1961. Hello, and welcome to The Other Half. Episode 5.18, Manuela Sainz, the unburied woman of Paeta. Last time, Manuela Sainz joined Bolívar in Bogotá as the liberator tried to keep the dream of Gran Colombia alive. Simón Bolívar was becoming more and more like Julius Caesar by the day. But unlike the great man of Rome, Bolívar had his mistress by his side on his Ides of March. Sainz saved Bolívar's life on at least two occasions. But she was not able to save his rule as president. She had done all she could, becoming his essential and indispensable lieutenant, but not even their combined strength of will could keep Bolívar in power. when we left the action, Bolivar had resigned the presidency and had skipped town. Today, we see Manuela Sainz make one last desperate effort to bring her lover back to power, while the Liberator wastes away, trying and failing to escape his labyrinth. But before we start the show, I'd like to thank all of my fantastic Patreon supporters. Your support is essential in keeping the show running, and I am sincerely thankful to each and every one of you. If you too would like to support the show, then visit patreon.com/theotherhalfpodcast, where you can become a patron for as little as a dollar a month. Additionally, you can follow the show on Facebook and Twitter, where we share bonus content from the episode, including pictures and maps to enhance your listening experience. To all my new listeners, welcome. To the rest of you, welcome back. Manuela Sainz did not follow her lover to Cartagena. Instead, she stayed in Bogotá. She did not see this as Bolívar's Waterloo, more as his Elba. He had suffered defeats before, even exile, but he had always returned stronger and outlasted his enemies. Why should this time be any different? They had lost this battle, but they would win the war. And to win it, Bolívar would need his best general to remain in the field. He had left her instructions, quote, "My love, I love you so much, but I will love you more if now, more than ever, you show good sense. Be careful with what you do, for otherwise you will lose both of us." She would need all of her strength and tenacity to continue the fight. With Bolívar out of the picture, the full force of the liberal propaganda machine came down on her. The newspapers were filled with invectives against her, and caricatures of her were burned in the streets. And while Bolívar had urged moderation, that wasn't exactly Manuela Sainz's strong suit. She issued stinging rebuttals in the press, and in the case of the caricatures, well, she got dressed in her colonel's uniform, gathered some bodyguards and female servants, also in military dress, and rode down the plaza to tear them down personally. These were protected by armed guards, so, naturally, she attacked. She fired her pistols in the air and charged. The resulting melee would only be broken up when the city guard showed up to reinforce her opponents, ushering her away and throwing her entourage in jail. The caricatures would quietly be removed soon after. When the new president held a parade, she yelled down at the crowd that Bolívar was the real president and engaged in a furious back-and-forth heckle with a few revelers. Some of her servants chucked firecrackers into the crowd, and when they countered with rocks, she and a male servant charged out with their guns, threatening to shoot. Only when a military friend showed up to de-escalate the situation did she regain control of herself. She even resorted to more student politics tactics, such as sending a servant out to put up homemade posters and distribute flyers all over the city, proclaiming, "Long live Bolívar, the founder of the Republic." She did have, though, some more subtle plans, such as, remembering her past successes, she tried to entice the garrison of Lima over to her side, sending an attractive female servant to ply them with gifts, booze, and flirtatious suggestions. The resulting splitting in loyalty resulted in clashes in the streets between various army factions, with liberals shouting, "Liberty or death!" and the Bolivarians countering with, "For religion!" Clearly Manuela's overtures towards the church were bearing fruit. The liberal government knew they had to get rid of this turbulent woman, so they launched a criminal investigation and issued an indictment. Among the charges were attempts to bribe soldiers into committing treason, insulting the public, and, quote, acting brusquely in a way alien to her sex, quote, dressing like a man, and, quote, breaking the laws of modesty and morality. She was banged to rights on all the criminal charges, but the fact that the government saw the need to attack her character shows just what a transgressive figure she was. There is nothing the patriarchy fears more than a rebellious woman acting outside of social norms. She avoided arrest for several weeks, not by going on the run, but through stalling tactics. This was one of her signature moves. She enjoyed nothing more than using rules meant to obstruct her against her enemies. On two occasions when they came, she claimed she was too ill to be taken into custody and continued to appeal against the charges against her. Her obstructive tactics enraged the liberal mobs, which threatened to lynch her if she did not comply. Finally, she decided that a tactical retreat was in order. She agreed to follow her lover into exile, settling in Guardas. But she had not gotten far before she heard the exciting news that forces loyal to Bolívar had beaten the liberals at the Battle of Santuario, forcing the resignation of the president. This was the chance that science had been waiting for, the opening she needed to allow for Bolívar's return. But in this hour of victory came tragedy. Bolívar had been complaining of illness again, and was now not answering her letters. She must have known what this meant, but she would not allow herself to acknowledge the terrible truth. She wrote to a friend, quote, "It is true that he has suffered from the return of his illness, but the liberator is immortal. Would that that were true." In early December 1830, she received a letter from one of Bolívar's companions telling her that the liberator was, quote, "In the arms of death and in peaceful agony, that cannot last for much longer." Science delayed going to his side, refusing to acknowledge that this was the end. She still had work to do to arrange his glorious return. He can't die now, but die he did, and it was an agonizing death. By the end, he could hardly talk, breathe, or stay conscious, and was in constant pain. He became delirious, crying out to comrades long dead. Though it is disputed, it's thought that his last words were, quote, "How will I ever get out of this labyrinth?" On the 17th of December, 1830, his doctor heard the death rattle. His remaining companions gathered at his side and watched the liberator die. Manuela Sainz would not hear about the death for several weeks. But when she did, she was overcome with grief. One of her followers later recalled, quote, "I arrived at Guardas at night, and Colonel Acosta, at whose house I alighted, came out to me crying aloud that Manuelita was dying, that she had been bitten by one of the most venomous of snakes. Did she want to die like Cleopatra? I went to her house, where I found her stretched out on a sofa, her right arm having swollen down to the shoulder. Immediately after the bite, she was made to take some warm rum beverage, the remedy employed by the people of this country, for it is believed that inebriation stops the action of the poison. Manuelita went to sleep, and the next morning she was well. I left her with the belief that she had made a deliberate attempt on her life." Now, this all seems a touch poetic and dramatic, but even if part of this is genuine, it does show a woman in the depths of despair. And it wasn't just over the death of the love of her life. It was the unravelling of her life's work. Without him, all hope of achieving his dream of a united Gran Colombia was ended. And, on a more personal note, she was devastated that she had not been there in his hour of need, to tend him in his final hours. But after a few weeks, she recovered herself, for there was much to do. Bolívar may have been born very rich, but a lifetime of revolutionary struggle has dwindled his fortune to almost nothing. This meant that he was not able to leave the love of his life much of anything. And Sainz had little wealth of her own to fall back on. She had spent freely and lived the life of a wealthy woman to keep up the pretense of august glory. but her creditors would not allow this to continue. In the short term, she got some money from rich friends and sold what little property she had left. While she tried to settle her personal affairs, she watched helplessly as first Venezuela and then Ecuador broke away from the Union of Gran Colombia. Even the Bolivarians in Bogota didn't do much to stop them. They had had enough of the endless war, turmoil and intrigue. It was time for a fresh start, and for these new, intrepid young republics to go it their own way. In 1831, the new Republic of New Granada, modern Colombia, issued a general pardon to all those convicted of political crimes, paving the way for the return of science's great enemy, Santander. The following year, he became the new nation's first president. One of the first things that President Santander had to contend with was an uprising by a Bolivarian loyalist. This conspiracy was discovered and dealt with relatively easily, with 46 men arrested and tried for treason. In the trial, one of them implicated Manuela Sainz, claiming that she had recruited over 100 conspirators to the plot. This was enough for Santander, who ordered her removal from the country. As you might imagine, she did not meekly comply with this order. Instead, once again, she dragged her feet. First, she said that she needed more time to get her affairs in order, getting her an extension of a few months from August to December 1833. When that day came, she said that she hadn't gotten around to booking her travel and needed yet more time. She needed to arrange a companion for her safety, and none was available just yet. By the time January came around, Santander finally lost his patience. She was given 13 days to leave, or she would be forced to. Sainz called their bluff, but they weren't bluffing. She awoke one morning to find the chief of police, 10 soldiers and 8 convicts outside her door, who were willing to carry her off by force if she did not comply. She claimed that she was too ill to move and yelled at them to leave. When they did not, she grabbed 2 pistols and threatened to kill the first man who tried to lay a finger on her. She reportedly said that she was tired of living and, quote, couldn't care less about sending a few men to the next world with her. She, though, was not able to make good on her threat, as one of the soldiers overpowered her, relieved her of the weapons, and forced her to the ground. Her hands were bound, and she was forced out of Bogota. She was taken first to Cartagena, and then put on a ship, bound for Jamaica. Now, to my mind, the thought of a peaceful retirement in Kingston, Jamaica, sounds pretty darn sweet. Manuela Sainz had lived a hard, full, high-octane life. They'd taken her across South America, enduring many hardships along with the high life. She had played her part in the great story of Latin American liberation, but her part, it appeared, had ended. She had been a revolutionary before Bolivar. Even if they had never met, she would have been an impactful player. But her partnership with Bolivar had catapulted her into the spotlight and given her a platform that she took full advantage of. But now, he was dead, and his dream of Gran Colombia was as well. No one would have blamed Manuela Sainz if she had gracefully departed the stage and enjoyed what remained of her days. But that wasn't Manuela Sainz. She was bored silly. She felt like she had no purpose. She needed to get back to South America. Fortunately for her, she still had friends back on the continent, one of whom was General Juan José Flores. An old revolutionary compadre of Sainz's, he had become the first president of Ecuador. But by 1835, he had been forced to relinquish the office to Vicente Rocafuerte. Flores, though, was still in control of the military and was an influential figure. This gave Sainz the confidence to board a ship and return to her home city of Quito. She landed in Guayaquil and began the journey to the capital. But around halfway through the trip, she was told to turn back. President Rocafuerte believed that she was there to overthrow him. After all, her brother, José María, had recently died fighting for a rebel army. The two were known to be close, and given Manuela's past, it was not an unreasonable supposition. She was absolutely outraged, dismissing the order as having been, quote, dictated by a drunkard and written by an imbecile. She insisted on her innocence. She was only in Ecuador to claim money that was owed her as part of her inheritance, she said. She appealed to her friend to help her, but Flores was unwilling to stick his neck out. Many men had underestimated Manuela Sainz, and they had paid the price. President Rocafuerte was not about to make the same mistake. He said that he knew well of her, quote, character, talents, vices, ambition, and prostitution. She was, according to him, quote, very proud, very insubordinate, very brazen. To him, she was, in every conceivable way, dangerous. Her association with Bolívar, her support amongst opponents of his regime, even her sex. She made every kind of representation she could. She tried indignation. She tried appealing to his better nature. But nothing worked. So she was expelled from the country of her birth and boarded a ship to the other country that she had once called home, Peru. Her destination, though, was not the capital Lima, where she had once lived. Instead, she settled in the port town of Paita. It was a pretty little place, its life dominated by the whaling industry. It was a favoured stopping point for New England whalers looking to replenish their stores and relax after a long time at sea. This had brought some prosperity to the town, as well as an eccentric array of characters from all over the world. She made friends quickly in this environment and became a familiar figure in the town. She even started her own business, a shop selling tobacco and sweets. She picked up extra work translating letters for passing sailors. It wasn't a roaring success. Money troubles would dog her for the rest of her life. But, for a while at least, it kept the creditors at bay. She became a somewhat popular figure in Paita. For example, we know that she helped find a doctor to cure a compatriot, and used her language and negotiation skills as an intermediary between local businessmen and American sailors. But though she did manage to set down some roots, the same yearning for adventure that had seen her leave Jamaica still lingered. She kept up her correspondence with Flores, and was overjoyed when he regained the presidency of Ecuador in 1839. But while she hoped this might hasten the end of her exile, it quickly became apparent that he had a different use for her in mind. Ecuador was engaging in a boundary dispute with Peru, and Flores asked her to intervene with the Peruvian government on his behalf. He also got her involved in his rather grandiosely titled scheme, the Grand Project. This was a plan to create a new confederation of states, uniting Peru, Bolivia, and Ecuador, with Flores as its leader. Of course, this appealed to Flores' vanity, while for Sainz it was an intriguingly Bolivarian-sounding dream. She was Flores' eyes and ears in Peru, and sent intelligence gathered from friends and contacts from throughout the region. She thought the whole area was ripe for an Ecuadorian invasion, and believed that the superior soldiers of her homeland would surely defeat the decadent, more affluent Peruvians. In this, I think Sainz betrayed something of a nationalist streak. Ever since she had met Bolívar, she had been committed to the dream of South American unification, but even so, she was, and always would be, a proud Ecuadorian at heart. She was tireless in supporting Flores, doing everything she could to help his cause and argue his case to what influential Peruvians would listen. She met with officials who were opposed to him and disrupted numerous plots and conspiracies, including several concocted by supposed friends and allies. In doing all of this, she built a great deal of credit with Flores, and as was typical with science, she used this to help the less fortunate. She was a minor celebrity in Paita, and her status among the various exiles and emigres of the town gave her power that she could use for good. In particular, she used her influence to help exiled Ecuadorians gain permission to return to their homeland. For example, in 1843, she wrote to Flores on behalf of a man called Oyabide, who was, quote, dying of illness and hunger, and who was, quote, not in a condition to be anyone's enemy, and had only a few years to live. He wants to be able to return home to rejoin his family in his dying days, and Manuela urged her friend, the president, to show him clemency. We don't know for sure what Flores said, but we do know he rarely said no to science. She did what she could to support her friend Flores, but his grand project would go no better than Bolivar's lofty dreams of Gran Colombia. Unfortunately for her, one of science's own friends turned out to be an implacable opponent of Flores. One of the most prominent Ecuadorians in Paita was Pedro Moncayo, a diplomat who had been once exiled by Flores but had since supposedly reconciled and been appointed as a consular official in the region. She discovered that, far from supporting Flores, he was secretly editor of an anti-Flores newspaper called The Magic Lantern and was plotting against the president. Now, she was in a tricky spot here. She would be at significant risk if Moncayo found out that he knew about his double life and had betrayed him to Flores. She had built good relationships with the emigre community in Paita. She didn't want to burn all of these bridges if she could help it. So she tried to be subtle about it, trying to guide Flores the truth without actually telling him. She encouraged him to look into the authorship of the Magic Lantern and forced the Peruvian government to launch an investigation. But, as I said, subtlety wasn't her strong suit. And so, when that failed, she told him about Moncayo directly, but urged him not to say who had told him about it. This way, she remained in the circle of trust for several anti-Flores conspirators, and was thus able to warn Flores of plots to overthrow him. She was living the life of a double agent, and sought to deflate the zeal of this little circle of would-be revolutionaries. She wrote to Flores, quote, I explained to them that your assassination would be the worst calamity for the country. We would inevitably bathe ourselves in blood and become the prey of our neighbouring republics. But while Manuela Sainz had many admirable qualities, she was not cut out for the deft subtleties that this plan required, and before long she was outed as a spy for Flores. The smoking gun came when two pro-government newspapers in Ecuador published letters that she had interrupted and passed on to the president, something that only she was in position to do. She was ostracized as an informant and a traitor, and her influence waned. Even so, she saw the revolution coming. She told Flores that the city of Guayaquil, quote, is where the revolution's focus is said to be. I'm giving you these warnings as a patriot. Unfortunately, Flores did not take Science's warnings seriously. In March 1845, the city of Guayaquil revolted, sparking a revolution that would sweep Flores from power. Once the so-called March Revolution was over, he was plonked onto a ship and sent into exile in Europe. The failure of Flores' grand project would mark Science's departure from the political scene. The generation of men that had followed Bolivar were now all either dead, in exile, or had repudiated his ideas. There was no one left from the old days that Science could back. She was now yesterday's woman. When the March Revolution hit, she was in her late 40s, and a lifetime of struggle had taken its toll. At some point in the 1840s, she became permanently disabled. We're not entirely sure how it happened, but court documents state that she had injured her hip to the extent that she had spent most of her day in a hammock. This testimony is backed up by none other than the Italian revolutionary Giuseppe Garibaldi, who, exiled from his native land, came to Paita in 1851. Science, perhaps seeing a little of her former lover in the dashing Garibaldi, invited him to stay at her home. He would later recall in his autobiography, quote, "At Paita, we landed and spent the day. I was hospitably received in the house of a benevolent lady, who had been confined to her bed for several years in consequence of a paralytic stroke, which deprived her of the use of her limbs. Dona Manuelita de Sainz was the most graceful and courteous matron that I ever saw. After that day, which, by contrast with so many, passed in pain and weakness, I may well call delicious, because I spent it in the interesting society of this invalid lady. I parted from her deeply touched. Both of us had tears in our eyes, knowing, no doubt, it was our last farewell on earth." Paita was hardly a hotbed of medical knowledge, and so the only treatments available to her were palliative rather than curative. One of them was to bathe in the bay, so she became a regular sight, carried to the sands in a litter pulled by mules. She must have been quite a sight. She was in constant pain, but the greater anguish would have been her forced confinement. She was a woman of action. Being forced to lie in bed all day would have been exquisite torture. Not to mention, this of course limited her ability to earn money, making it all the more crucial that she obtain any that was owed to her. She had some property in Quito, earning rent and a few investments, but her estate manager, one Pedro Sanz, was, well, let's just say he had his hand in the till. Unfortunately, from her sickbed in Paita, there wasn't an awful lot she could do about it. In 1847, she received the shocking news that her husband, Dr. James Thorne, had been murdered. He had apparently been walking with his mistress when he was ambushed and killed by a group of marauding enslaved men. The two of them had never fully reconciled, though they had corresponded a few times in the years since she had gone into exile. While she was keen to see the killers brought to justice, her greater concern was financial. In theory, she was entitled to half of the wealth he had earned during their marriage. Unfortunately, there was a clause that stated that a widow who had acted in an immoral manner, such as adultery, would forfeit those rights. After a lengthy legal case, it was determined that what remained of Dr. Thorne's legal estate after debts had been paid would be split among his four principal heirs. Manuela Sainz was not one of those. All she got was a minor bequest that he left in his will, which was the 8,000 peso diary her father had given him. And she wouldn't even get that properly. She would only ever see a fraction of it. Even in death, her husband was making life difficult for her in the most boring way possible. Her financial problems only increased in the coming years, barely supporting even her most basic needs. Her lawyer described her as, quote, "living in Paita in a pitiful hut, submerged in the worst kind of misery, without any sort of income on which to subsist, and dependent for her daily bread on the charity of various friends." It was an ignoble end for a woman of such historical significance, and a stunning fall from grace. Fortunately, though, by the 1850s, it appears that she managed to unlock some of the money owed to her in Quito, and was able to rise from destitution. She was far from wealthy, but she could at least support herself and once again welcome friends and guests to her home. Among them was a young Ecuadorian politician called Gabriel Garcia Moreno, who had been exiled for his revolutionary views. Ever one to cultivate the passions of a young firebrand, she and he discussed politics and revolution. Her advice and passion inspired Moreno, and she connected him with a few old contacts to help him get back on his feet. This would eventually lead to Moreno leading a successful revolt against the Ecuadorian president with the help of her old friend Flores, leading to him becoming president in 1861. Unfortunately, she would not live to see it. Towards the end of June 1856, she contracted a serious illness, possibly diphtheria. After a few months of battling disease, she died on the 23rd of November. She was 58 years old. From the moment that she breathed her last, Manuela slipped into anonymity. We don't even know where she is buried. And for around half a century, she was barely remembered at all. From 1860 to 1940, only three historical works even mentioned her involvement in the Bolivarian Revolution. And those that did focus heavily on her heroics in the attempt on his life and nothing more. These references tend to focus on her beauty and infatuation with the liberator rather than her own qualities and actions. Even after the Second World War, when she became more regularly mentioned, it was usually in a negative light. She was seen as an embarrassment for Bolivar, an immoral hussy that got in the way of him realizing his dream. Some historians, though, did buck this trend. In 1944, she received her first full biography by Ecuadorian writer Alfonso Romazzo González, who commended her as a heroine of the revolution. A flawed woman, to be sure, but one to be celebrated. This view of science, as a heroine, was taken up by a new generation of firebrands in the 1960s, including the writer Pablo Neruda, who wrote a haunting lyrical eulogy to her called The Unburied Woman of Paita, an extract from which I read at the start of the episode. In the 1980s, she became an icon of a growing Ecuadorian feminism movement. In 1989, a gathering of leading feminists went to Paita to pay homage to Manuela Sainz and signed the Declaration of Paita, in which they vowed to follow Sainz's example by combating all forms of neo-colonial injustice. In recent years, Ecuador has finally recognized her as one of the key figures in its liberation and the wider story of South American independence. This culminated in 2007 with her being symbolically promoted to the rank of general in the army of Ecuador. If you find yourself in Quito, you can visit the Manuela Sainz Museum, where you can find artifacts from her life. If you can't make it all the way to Ecuador, you could watch one of the films or TV series made about her. One of them, made in 2000, starts with the arrival in Paita of the American novelist Herman Melville. This is based on true events. Melville did meet Manuela Sainz. Remember, Paita was a popular stopping-off point for American whalers. And he never forgot her. In 1854, shortly before her death, he published a collection of short stories called The Encantadas, or The Enchanted Isles. In one of them, he told the story of a woman called Junila, a woman abandoned on an island. Invoking the memory of Manuela Sainz, Melville wrote, quote, "As mariners, lost in tempest on some desolate ledge, patch them a boat out the remnants of their vessel's wreck, and launch it in the selfsame waves, see here Junila, this lone shipwrecked soul out of treachery invoking trust. Humanity, thou strong thing, I worship thee, not in the laureled victor, but in this vanquished one."
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.